Good morning. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're going to start today's show by discussing the results of yesterday's recall election. Governor Gavin Newsom beat the GOP-led recall, which cost the state an estimated $276 million. He's now the second governor in U.S. history to beat a recall attempt. The AP's current numbers are showing that around 64% of voters voted no, with 36% of voters voting yes. Over 9.1 million ballots have been tallied so far. Some examples of the election results: Shasta, Yuba, Modoc, and Lassen counties overwhelmingly voted yes on the recall. In San Francisco, more than 87% of voters voted no. According to the New York Times, the results largely mirror the 2020 presidential election. Counties that went for President Biden largely stuck with Governor Newsom. Larry Elder did come out as the frontrunner for the Republican candidates. Now, Governor Newsom's term is up next year, so voters will have another chance to decide if he should remain governor in November of 2022. So we can stay tuned for that. But now on today's show, we're discussing how two new housing bills could tackle California's housing crisis. According to state data, California is short at least 1.8 million homes relative to our population. Now, for years, the state has failed to pass major housing bills that would address this shortage, until maybe now. The California legislature recently approved Senate Bill 9, authored by California Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins. Senate Bill 9 would allow up to 4 units to be built on single-unit lots across the state. Senator Atkins said, quote, "This bill can help make the dream of home ownership possible. It stands to help make communities more inclusive, and it stands to set this state up on a path where there are more housing options, more supply, and more access to the California dream," unquote. Now, the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley estimates that SB 9 could create up to 710,000 new homes that are financially feasible. And the legislature also approved Senate Bill 10, authored by State Senator Scott Wiener, representing San Francisco. SB 10 would let local governments rezone single-unit parcels to allow as many as 10 units. Governor Newsom has until October 10th to veto or sign these bills. And if you have any questions or comments about SB 9 and SB 10, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at yourcall@kalw.org. And now here today, joining us to discuss these two bits of potentially major housing legislation, we are very pleased to be joined by David Garcia, who's the policy director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley, whose study I just referenced. David leads the center's engagement in local, state, and federal housing policy, and he worked on that recent report called "Will Allowing Duplexes and Lot Splits on Parcels Zoned for Single Family Create New Homes?" So, David, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Ethan, appreciate the opportunity. Good to be here.
So, David, it's no secret that California has a housing shortage, and I know your center has worked on this issue for a number of years now. On top of an ever-growing homelessness crisis, it's becoming more and more expensive to buy or rent a home in the state. The median home price recently eclipsed $800,000. Can you tell us how we ended up here?
Yeah, well, you have to go back several decades, right? We didn't get into this housing crisis overnight. It took a long time for these forces to culminate in what we see today. But the long and short of it is we simply don't have enough homes for the people who would like to call California home. And that has driven up prices, as you referenced. It has also exacerbated our homelessness issues as well. If you look back at how much we used to build in the state in the 70s, 80s, we used to build routinely upwards of 200,000 new units per year. Contrast that to today and what is supposed to be an economic boom, we're only building half that. In a good year, we build about 100,000 new units a year, when the State Department of Housing says that we need to be building closer to that 200,000 number. And this has been the case for 20-ish years, right, where we just have not been building enough housing to meet demand. And so we see after the Great Recession that even though a lot of economies rebounded, home prices rebounded, we started to very quickly realize that the supply of housing was not keeping up with the demand. And so there's many reasons why we didn't build enough homes over the course of the last 20, 30 years. But really that's the long and short of it, is that we simply have not matched our housing output that historically the state's been able to hit.
And David, I want to get into some of those factors that have contributed to the slowdown of production relative to our population growth and demand. But just in terms of the numbers of how short we are in homes, I said that there was a state estimate that we're shy at least 1.8 million homes. But when we say housing shortage, what exactly do we mean? What's that number, and how do we arrive at it?
Yeah. So there's some debate about what that number is, right? And it really depends on the metrics you use to determine, you know, what that shortage really is. And some estimates are as high as 3.5 million. And a lot of times those are over time. Like, we need to build those over 10 years in order to meet existing demand, but also keep up with future demand too. And so however you cut it, though, it's in the millions. And there is no way to get around it. We just don't have enough homes. And so it really just depends on the metrics you're using. But I won't comment on how different organizations come up with those numbers, but I think they all have some validity to them. We can quibble over whether it's 3 million or 2 million or less than that. But I think the pace that we're hitting shows that we're nowhere near even the low end of those estimates.
And let's talk about reasons why that pace has slowed. And one of the factors, it seems to be zoning. And about two-thirds of California right now is currently zoned just for single-unit homes. And in the Bay Area, it's even higher. Mm-hmm. 82% of all residential land in the Bay Area is zoned for single-family or single-unit housing only. And that's according to your colleagues at the Othering and Belonging Institute at UC Berkeley. So that means that no multifamily housing, no duplexes, no fourplexes, certainly no apartment buildings are allowed in over 82% of our residential land. So would you peg the root of this crisis on this type of restrictive local zoning, or are there other factors we should be looking at too?
I would say there are several roots, right? So one of them certainly is restrictive zoning, which, as you laid out, really limits the areas which we're allowed to build and the type of housing that we can build too. And some of those numbers are even higher in other communities. I actually just learned on Monday that San Jose is actually 97% reserved for single family only housing. So I think depending on where you're at, it can be even dramatically more imbalanced. And that's a challenge because, you know, we have a finite amount of land in California. We're very conscious about consuming too much prime ag land or farmland. And so we, and we're also bounded by geography, right? Mountains, the bay, the ocean, so that we have limited places where we can build. And so by kind of artificially restricting the land where we can build new housing from single family only zoning really makes the pool of eligible developable sites really small. So we have to look at things like surplus land or land that formerly, you know, had heavy industry on it or needs significant toxic cleanup. That's really expensive and quite frankly is not going to be enough for us to kind of dig ourselves out of that hole. So zoning is certainly a factor. We've also increasingly seen that the cost to build housing in California is extraordinarily high, right? So we did some research on this. We released last year when we found that over the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, the cost to build a unit of housing has grown exponentially throughout the state. You know, it's still cheaper to build in places like the Inland Empire or the Central Valley, but that does not mean that it is inexpensive. And so everywhere you look in California, prices have risen. And as a result, the cost to rent or buy those homes has risen as well. And there's a number of reasons why that's the case. Some of it is intentional, right? We have very intentional laws around seismic standards for housing, for environmental standards, green housing, things like that, all really important goals that we should be striving to achieve. We also have to understand that, you know, that does make housing more expensive too. And then we also have kind of a challenge with having enough folks to build homes, right? After the Great Recession, there was a bit of an exodus, particularly of highly skilled labor. And by some estimates, we haven't necessarily gotten back to those levels. And so there's a supply, a shortage of labor supply as well. So I always like to tell people, you know, we can rezone all we want. And there are many reasons why we should do that. But it's also really expensive to build in California. And unless we tackle that challenge as well, we're still not going to be able to provide homes that are more affordable to more people than what can be built today, based on the economics that the market presents us with.
Well, and David, your comment about workers leaving the state with the Great Recession, I wonder if some of that is a negative feedback loop here from the housing crisis. If the housing prices make it unaffordable for people to stay, we're going to keep losing our middle class workers, mm-hmm. who we need to help us build our way out of this problem potentially. But going back to this issue of zoning, you know, you commented how we've really slowed down the pace of production in the last couple decades, but zoning has been around since the 1920s, 1930s, and we know it has a long history of racial exclusion. Berkeley, for example, is one of the first communities to have single-family zoning, and I think it was done explicitly to exclude non-white races from the community there. Can you talk a bit about this history of zoning and why it's, if we've always had it, why did it suddenly become a factor in slowing production just in the last few decades?
Yeah. So going back to kind of the origins of single family only zoning, you kind of hit the nail on the head. A lot of communities were kind of barred from using race as a means to exclude people from neighborhoods. And so instead they started using, you know, housing typology, right? If you can exclude certain areas of your city from multifamily buildings, which were largely considered to be places where people of color would live, low-income people would live, then you could ostensibly keep your community racially exclusive. And so that was a way for a lot of communities to try and get around Supreme Court rulings that said, no, you can't actually use race as a means to exclude people from your neighborhood. And so, like you said, Berkeley, ironically, because today they're kind of one of the pioneers of opening up single family zoning, or at least they've stated their intent to do that. Back then they were one of the first cities, if not the first, to implement some of these policies. But you know, it's not just the implementation of single family zoning, but when you get into the 70s and 80s, you also have a series of down zonings where you had places that did allow for multifamily, but for very similar reasons, community groups banded together to try and advocate for the down zonings of those places, right? So there are communities where you were allowed to build multifamily projects and that were lobbied by homeowners to actually reduce the intensity that could be built in those neighborhoods. And today you see this in a lot of neighborhoods where they do have a lot of multifamily stock mixed in with single family homes, but you won't find any new multifamily projects because they're explicitly banned, even though originally they were allowed to take hold in those neighborhoods. So that's kind of the evolution of exclusionary zoning. It didn't just happen, 100 years ago. It's kind of been an ongoing, change as communities have tried to keep exclusionary character in their areas.
Well, and on that point of just how long this crisis has been in the making, for years the California legislature has failed really to pass any major legislation that could address the state's housing shortage and affordability crisis. There have been some attempts, most recently some of the bills that Scott Wiener, state senator from San Francisco, has proposed. So why haven't lawmakers at the state level been successful? What do you attribute the holdup to?
Yeah. Well, I mean, housing is a contentious issue, and it makes sense, right? Where you live is very personal to you. And so the idea that where you live may change, no matter what that change is kind of a scary for some people. And I think that's a reasonable kind of first impression to have. And that manifests itself in, the votes of our policymakers who are, voted in by these folks. So, there's that component of it too. But also there are a lot of stakeholders who are involved in housing decisions throughout the state, and they're very engaged in Sacramento. And so even if there may be general consensus on what the policy solutions are for housing and what we should do legislatively, it is very hard to pass bills in Sacramento because you do need a pretty significant consensus amongst all of these varied stakeholders, from environmental groups to housing advocates to equity advocates to the trades. All of these groups generally share the goal of building more housing. But once you get into the details of legislation, there's a lot of disagreement, and that makes it very hard to pass not just any legislation, but just kind of legislation we know would actually move the needle. And so that becomes very challenging. And so this year has been somewhat encouraging, because we have seen the passage of bills like Senate Bill 9 and Senate Bill 10, which did get very vocal opposition, right? As I'm sure you noticed this, but there are several groups who are kind of vehemently opposed to these kinds of statewide bills that would loosen regulations in single family areas. And so I think it's a testament to the Senate leadership and to the advocacy community who's been pushing these ideas, not just this year, but for several years to try and address this issue of racially exclusionary zoning, but also address the issue of, the fact that we just need more homes. And so
Let's talk about some of the details of those bills. I think that's really important to walk listeners through it. First, I just want to let everyone know that you're listening to Your Call. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. And we're talking about two new major pieces of legislation that California State Legislature just passed to potentially address the state's housing shortage. And we're very pleased to be joined by David Garcia, Policy Director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. You can join the conversation if you have questions, comments, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. But David, let's dig into some of the details of Senate Bill 9. So it was authored by the Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins. It was a bipartisan vote, 45-19. So can you just walk us through what SB 9 will do?
Yeah. So SB 9 basically allows two things. It allows a homeowner to convert or build up to two units of housing on an existing single family lot. It also allows that owner to split the lot into two legally separate parcels, and then build up to two units on that new lot as well, which means they can be separately conveyed, they can be sold. This basically means that homeowners can build up to four units on an existing single family parcel. That said, there are a number of restrictions in the bill which limit its applicability. Right. So there are geographic restrictions. They're supposed to only be in urban areas or infill locations. There's restrictions on fire zones as well. And there's also restrictions on lot size. It can't be smaller than 2,500 square feet. There's restrictions on the percentages of size that the new lots would create. And then there's also some language in there about tenant protections, right? You're not supposed to be able to use this bill if there are existing renters on the site. So that's in there as well. A last-minute amendment was put in a couple weeks before it was passed that actually limits this to owner occupants as well. So if you want to split the lot and build two homes on a new piece of land that used to be your single-family parcel, you have to sign a legal document stating that you will not move for 3 years. So this is an attempt to try and dissuade speculation, the concern that you may have developers knocking on people's doors and, offering cash for keys to try and get them out so that they can, use SB9 to profit, essentially. So now with this owner occupancy requirements, only owners themselves can avail themselves of the lot split provisions of SB9. I'll stop there because I think it's getting into the weeds, but that's basically the details of the bill and some of the details that we used in our analysis of Senate Bill 9 as well.
Well, let's talk about that analysis because, given all the restrictions that you mentioned, perhaps this bill may not be as far-reaching as certainly some of the opponents are concerned about. And your team at Turner Center at UC Berkeley did put out the report that I referenced earlier this past July about SB9. And you found some very interesting things in running your analysis. Of course, it's all kind of projections, but you base them on a lot of sound analysis here. And you found that SB9 would create more than 700,000 new homes that are, quote, financially feasible. So can you just explain to listeners, what do you mean by financially feasible?
Yeah, that's a great point. So that 700,000 number, I think, should be put in context because, again, that's what we determined to be financially feasible, which means that it pencils out for a developer or a homeowner, right? That they can absorb the cost of building new homes or converting their existing homes while clearing a certain financial threshold that would make it financially advantageous for them to do so. That 700,000 means that we identified parcels where some combination of new development as provided by Sinimple 9 would be financially advantageous for the developer or the homeowner. It does not mean that they will actually get built. I want to be very clear about that. So just because something makes sense on paper doesn't mean that the homeowner is actually going to do this themselves. Doesn't mean they're going to sell to a developer. So we expect that of that 700,000 number of units that are financially feasible, a very small fraction of those would actually get built, at least in the near term, before economic conditions change very much. And so this is important because even if I'm a homeowner today, and you know, according to our analysis, it makes financial sense to split my lot and build two homes, doesn't mean I'm going to do that because that's ostensibly a really stressful undertaking to build new housing, right? And so if I am an owner-occupant, I may not necessarily have the patience or the money or the wherewithal to do that. And so that, I think that's important to note as well, is this is really incumbent upon the homeowner now, especially with the owner-occupancy requirements, to use Sinimple 9 to do this. This is very similar to accessory dwelling unit laws that were recently passed, right? So basically everyone in the state can build an accessory dwelling unit or two on their lots. But, we have seen an uptick in ADU development, but it hasn't been, that widespread. I think that was one of the concerns of ADU law when it was passed, is that now everyone's going to build a backyard granny flat, but that certainly hasn't happened. And I expect similar dynamics here with Sinimple 9.
And to your point about earlier point about speculators and developers getting involved in this, so we have an email from Sarah who writes, "I'm glad you're covering this issue. I hope to hear the impact of the hedge funders and outside money people who were snapping up homes that people had been thrown of." And she's referring to what happened after the last Great Recession. Mm-hmm. She writes, "Many of those homes were left empty, waiting for someone to make a profit." Is that same dynamic going to play out now with this lot split bill?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think was a lot of the discussion in the legislatures is not wanting to unintentionally create a market where homes are snapped up. What I will say to that is that happens today already, right? With single family homes, you have groups like real estate investment trusts or REITs. They will buy portfolios of units in single family homes, but the reason they do it is not because they are their business model is to create new units out of that one single family lot. It's because the homes themselves have gained tremendous value over the last couple of years. And if you listen to earnings calls or reports from these groups, they are explicit. They say that they are entering markets where supply is low and there's very low likelihood that new supply will come online, right? Because this makes their, quote, investment of a single family home much more valuable to them as an investment. And so kind of response to these kind of questions is the best way to combat kind of this Wall Street's incursion into single family homes is to simply build more housing products so that the value of these homes does not make them so lucrative from a investment standpoint, right? For Wall Street firms, right? These should be wealth building opportunities for people. And so to the extent that we can add more homes to these neighborhoods, that tempers some of the speculative activity from Wall Street. So that's very different from a group who may buy a home with the express intent of building new units on that home, right? These are different financial actors. Mm-hmm. So, but now you don't have as big of an impact probably because of this owner occupancy requirement. I do think it's going to be pretty significant deterrent from that standpoint.
That kind of speculation. Absolutely. Well, I also want to ask you about the impact on affordable housing. You talked about maybe 710,000 financially feasible new homes, but who are the people who are going to be able to afford these homes? And we're talking about affordable housing. What are the income levels? Do you think this will ultimately boost affordability?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable kind of conversation to have about this bill. One of the key I think arguments against Simple 9 has been that there's no requirement for affordability, and that's certainly correct, right? There is no intention that they would require any sort of deed restriction on any new units built. And I think that that's intentional, right? Because once you start talking about 1 and 2 unit projects, requiring affordability deed restrictions on those units becomes financially infeasible, essentially. And now you're asking a homeowner to become a regulatory agent and making sure that these things are continuously affordable and that the deed restriction is followed. And so that's probably going to not work for a lot of homeowners who would like to undertake this. That being said, I do think the homes that may be built as a result of Sustainable 9 have the opportunity to be more attainable than homes that are currently available in the single family market. And I say that because of the requirements of the bill that still allow cities to limit the size of what is built, right? So cities have to allow up to 800 square feet per new unit in Sustainable 9. That's a small unit, right? So most single family homes are going to be much larger than that. And so if you have a lot of 800 square foot, 1 or 2 bedrooms, basically starter homes that are being built in place of, let's say, a 2,000 square foot home or something like that. On a net basis, those are probably going to be less expensive than the home that they replaced. That may not be the case everywhere. I think you probably will have some examples where the market is driving prices up higher, even if the units themselves are smaller. But in a lot of instances, because the homes are just going to be smaller scale as a result both of the city restrictions and the geometry of the parcel itself, we think that you will see more affordability come out of these homes, not deed-restricted affordability, but homes that are more attainable to more people in California.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about how two new housing bills in California plan to tackle the state's housing crisis. We're talking about SB 9 and SB 10, which were recently passed by the California legislature. And we're very pleased to be joined by David Garcia from the Turner Center at UC Berkeley. How will these bills ensure that there is more affordable housing? What questions or comments do you have about SB 9 and SB 10? I'm Ethan Elkind. This is your call, and we'll be back right after this. For those of you joining us now, I'm Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. We're talking about SB 9 and SB 10, two potentially major housing bills that recently passed the California legislature. We want to know what questions or comments you have about them. You can join the conversation by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. You can also reach us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @yourcallradio. We're joined by David Garcia, who's going to be staying with us for about another 10 minutes before I know he has to go. He's the policy director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley, where he leads the center's engagement in local, state, and federal housing policy. So let's go to the phone lines. We have William from Belvedere calling in. William, welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you very much. Recently, there was an article in our local newspaper, the Marin Independent Journal, that described the complexities involved in this legislation. One of the things also mentioned was that there's enough resistance that there'll be a ballot initiative to overturn them. But some of the reasons why there might be a ballot initiative to overturn them doesn't have to do with racial prejudice or economic prejudice or other things, but that the fact that the left hand doesn't seem to know what the right hand is doing in these two examples, local examples, because everything is local, really, because people only live in one place. Here in on the Tiburon Peninsula, as in all of Marin County, there's no water. We're out of water. And there's no expectation of having a whole lot of water. And yet people are talking about building a whole lot of housing units in Marin County. The second
All right, well, William, I think you're raising an important point about the environmental impacts of adding more housing in here. So I wanted to let David Garcia weigh in on this. David, what's your response to first of all, William raises a couple points, the response to the possibility of a ballot initiative. And then secondly, does the left hand know what the right hand is doing when it comes to housing policy in California?
Sure. On the specter of a ballot initiative, I've seen the language that was filed with the state on that. I think it remains to be seen whether or not that is that comes to fruition. This has been something that's been talked about by proponents of kind of local control for some time. So it's interesting to see it now. And actually, I think it was actually filed the day that Senate Bill 9 was passed or shortly thereafter. So really kind of interesting timing. I do think there is something to be said about, you know, the questions of, you know, are we cognizant of the infrastructure impacts, the water, sewer, things like that, of allowing development in already developed areas? And so a couple points to make there. The first is that the ability to build in infill areas is shown to actually be much less harmful on existing infrastructure and resources than, say, the alternative, which is building in more suburban, exurban places where per capita water usage is higher, per capita vehicle miles traveled is much higher. And so if we're trying to think about developing in an environmentally conscious way, actually the most advantageous way to do that is to allow for more intensity in low density areas that are already built out. One thing to consider too is that a lot of times these places were built out with much higher population assumptions, right? So if I'm building a 3-bedroom house as an engineer, I have to assume that, you know, I have 1.5 people in each bedroom. And so I have to make sure that the utilities and the water can handle all of that. We know that the average household, not just in California, but the United States, has been declining. And so the assumptions we made for these neighborhoods 20, 30 years ago actually shows us we have a lot of capacity in these neighborhoods. And I'll also say, as we've seen with ADUs, we don't expect any units that come as a result of Senate Bill 9 or any single family zoning reform bill to dramatically change any one neighborhood or one community, right? So even if you add a couple homes here on the block, it's very unlikely that you're going to overwhelm an entire infrastructure system. So I'll kind of leave it there. I think those are important points to bring up because I think they are totally fair and valid, but it's important to remember that a lot of this is very dynamic, and adding one or two homes on a block is not necessarily going to result in anything catastrophic.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, David, thank you for answering William's question. We appreciate William dialing in with that. I realize we should also talk about SB 10. We've spent a lot of time talking about SB 9. Mm-hmm. So, David, can you describe for listeners what SB 10 does or would propose to do?
Yeah. So SB 10, in contrast, SB 9 is voluntary, whereas SB 9 is kind of a mandate to all jurisdictions. SB 10 can be used by cities who would like to more easily rezone low-density areas for up to 10 units per parcel. So not all cities are going to use this, but I imagine a lot of cities who are proactively thinking about, say, allowing fourplexes in single-family zones or up to 10 units in some areas, they may find this bill really helpful. Because when cities go through rezonings to allow for more units, they have to go through the California Environmental Quality Act, the CEQA process. They have to put together a full environmental impact report. This bill would basically allow cities to largely bypass that process to allow them to implement these reforms quicker. And so a lot of cities who are thinking about meeting their really high new state mandated housing goals, they're probably going to think about using SB 10 to allow them to do this quicker. So again, this is a much more targeted policy where it's kind of enticing cities to do the planning work on their own. And I think you will see a lot of cities who are already considering changes to their single family zoning use SB 10 as a way to expedite this.
And David, assuming that SB 9 and SB 10 both pass, what would be your prediction for the neighborhoods, the cities, the locations around the state that would see changes? So where do you think the lot splits would likely happen? Where do you think those local governments might be located that would take advantage of the SB 10 approach of being able to rezone up to 10 units in a more streamlined fashion?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I guess the short answer is I don't anticipate it to change anyone city or community or block very noticeably, right? The effects, we anticipate them to be pretty spread out. I will say some of the factors that lead to higher potential feasibility are things like larger lot sizes, right? So a lot of times we see less feasibility on older, smaller lots simply because there's just not enough space to build another unit or another two units. It doesn't pencil out. We also see mostly in areas where rents and sales prices are higher, the feasibility there goes up. I think there's concern that developers are going to go to kind of the areas where land is least expensive, right? Because they think that'll be most attractive. But it's actually the places that are more affluent, that command higher rents and prices, where we show the feasibility is higher. So I think those are some of the key characteristics of places that will be more impacted by things like Sensible 9 and Sensible 10. I'll also say that cities themselves still maintain a pretty significant amount of local control. They can control how the new development looks. They can control the height and basically the size outside of 800 square feet. And so for cities that kind of decide to embrace things like Sensible 9 and pass ordinances that conform and maybe build on it, they may see more of an impact too. But that might be a community choice to decide to try to facilitate more development as a result of these bills.
All right. David Garcia, Policy Director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining us on your call.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot, Ethan.
All right. And we're going to continue this conversation on both SB 9 and SB 10. We're very pleased to be joined by Robin Yorovich. She's a staff reporter for Capital and Maine, who covers California's housing crisis and economic inequality. And we'll talk about some of the opposition to these bills. So, Robin, welcome to your call. Hopefully we've got Robin there. I do want to remind our listeners that you can dial in to join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And you can also email us with any questions at yourcall@kalw.org. So, Robin, do we have you on the line?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me.
Great. Oh, so glad you can join us. And there has been an intense debate over SB 9 and SB 10. It doesn't seem to have been just a sort of typical NIMBY, not my backyard versus YIMBY, yes in my backyard kind of debate. And you wrote in a recent piece whether SB 9 would actually lead to more affordable home ownership opportunities and low-cost rentals. Housing that California needs the most is a matter of intense debate. And you write that housing is primarily a private business, even though lawmakers can try to incentivize more affordable housing. They're not the ones with the power to actually build the homes or control the market. So can you describe a bit about what the critics are saying about SB 9 and SB 10?
Yeah. Some of the critics, as you pointed out, are housing equity advocates, you know, who say that there's no affordability guarantee and no funding to make this housing affordable. And then there are homeowner groups who, you know, have the major concerns of traffic, noise, neighborhood character, parking. And, you know, then there are also cities who object to Sacramento coming in and telling them what to do with their land use policies. And I think they feel that some of these, you know, when Sacramento says that you have to build this much or you have to open up this much of your city to denser housing, that, you know, that kind of puts them in a tough position with their constituents who want to keep dense housing away. So that's kind of in a nutshell, like, who are the people that have opposed this bill?
And let's talk about some of these main groups that have spoken out most prominently against SB 9 and SB 10. There's a neighborhood group called Livable California, and then a group, Housing is a Human Right, which is a division of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. And they say that these bills will further gentrification. Can you just first just describe who these groups are, where they get their funding from, who they're made up of, et cetera?
Yeah, Housing is a Human Right is part of the AIDS Healthcare Foundation. And it's famously well-funded. This is a group that has been very involved in housing issues. They were the main proponent of the rent control initiative that was on the ballot just recently and before in 2018. And they have staunchly opposed this because they say that it is going, just like you said, it's going to lead to gentrification because there are no provisions for affordable housing in these bills. And then Livable California is kind of seems to be a coalition of groups, includes a lot of homeowners associations and kind of people with maybe what you would say traditional NIMBY concerns. But they've also piggybacked on this idea that this policy, you know, of increasing density is misguided because it will lead to gentrification. And And among, you know, among those groups are people, they're just a, it's just a really wide range. You know, it's people in really rich neighborhoods, and it's also people in neighborhoods that are at risk of gentrification. And what some of them say is that these developers, you know, who may want to build a duplex or a small apartment building are not going to go to Beverly Hills or, you know, another rich community. They're going to go to their neighborhoods and build these more dense housing complexes and charge premium prices for them and therefore push out some of the long-term residents.
Well, in addition to these groups, we've also got the LA City Council that's come out against SB 9 and SB 10. Kevin DeLeon, the former state Senate leader, is now a member of the LA City Council, said he agrees California needs more housing, but thinks these bills don't set aside units for those lowest earners. And he told Cal Matters, quote, the question is not just sort of more inventory stock, but the question is what type of housing will be produced and for who. So this echoes these points that you mentioned, that people are upset that there's not more in there for affordable housing for lower income groups, but particularly for a lot split bill. How would you even mandate affordable housing, you know, for someone? We heard David Garcia walk through the challenges of that. If you're splitting your home and you're the owner occupant, how would you even get the subsidies to make a unit affordable?
That might be difficult. I mean, I think there are provisions in those bills that would allow cities to require some deed restricted housing, you know, in other words, that, you know, it has to have affordability provisions. But, you know, what you're saying kind of highlights the whole problem with California's approach to building more housing and trying to solve the housing crisis is that it depends on the free market to develop all this housing. And it's, you know, the idea is that if you build more densely and if you kind of get out of the way by removing fees and other obstacles to development, then affordable housing will come. And that just doesn't seem to be happening, you know, in a lot of cities, like in dense parts of LA and San Francisco, you know, prices are very, very high.
All right, well, let's go to the phone lines. We have Lisa calling in from San Francisco. So, Lisa, welcome to your call.
Yes, good morning. Thought-provoking discussion, as always. I have just a few thoughts. One is both guests have been referring to homeowners and developers, and we hear very, very little of tenants. And, you know, in San Francisco specifically, over 60% of our population our tenants, some are young, some are old, some are low income, some have middle income. And so the fact that these two new pieces of legislation have very little to do requirements for deeply affordable housing for low income people is problematic. And secondly, I'd like to dovetail what the gentleman from Belvedere said about water. Specific to San Francisco, our Senator, Scott Wiener, who is very pro-density, pro-build, build, build, market rate development, he is nowhere on public transit. There is no additional public transit in our city, and we're even having problems opening up Muni right now. The mayor is going to turn everything over to robocars and private markets and public-private relationships. And so water and public transit with new development are critical. We cannot be experimented on by market rate housing analysts. I mean, it's nuts.
I think you're raising important points, similar to William, in terms of the environmental impacts on transit as well as water. But also your point about tenants is an important one. And Robin, what would you say to tenants? I mean, most of the state, or maybe not most, but about half the state are renters. So what do you say to tenants about this bill? How will this about both bills, SB 9, SB 10? How do you think that they will ultimately affect tenants here in California?
Well, tenants are really at the center of the housing crisis. I mean, one of the things that we can't forget is that is really what's driving the crisis, that low-income renters who can't find an affordable place to live. I mean, there's a central mismatch between the wages that people earn and housing prices. And, you know, the theory is that if you build more, prices will go down. that doesn't seem to be happening in super pricey parts of the state. I mean, it might be necessary to build density might be a necessary condition for affordability, but it's not enough. So, you know, these bills are meant, I think, to benefit tenants or people who are searching for housing. But, you know, it's unclear what the impact will be.
Although I guess proponents would argue that if you can boost the supply of housing, that that could potentially stabilize prices, at least. You wouldn't see demand outstripping supply like we've seen over the last few decades. But let's go to this to a similar point, Robin, that we were just discussing, where we have an email from an anonymous listener who writes, leaders should focus on increasing wages and providing childcare so people of color can afford a single-family home in a neighborhood zoned for single-family homes. SB 9 and SB 10 push people of color toward letting go of the American dream of single-family home ownership and towards settling for owning something like one part of a duplex, fourplex, or renting. So I think this listener's comment really gets to the point of who will SB 9 and SB 10 benefit. Are the bills just putting a dent in this, or are they really able to solve our affordability crisis? And if they don't, then what's needed? What would your response be, Robin?
Well, I think that even the proponents of the bill would say that, you know, at its most ambitious, these bills won't solve the housing crisis, but they're sort of a tool towards solving it. And, you know, whether they're an effective tool or not, that's a whole nother discussion, which is really the discussion we're having. But it is true. What the caller points out is that people of color have brought up that one important constituency that has opposed the bills are people of color who are homeowners in established neighborhoods who say that is where developers are going to go to build their multifamily buildings, and they are going to drive up prices in those areas for renters, you know, gentrifying the area and encourage homeowners to sell and, you know, leave the little piece of wealth that they've been able to build up and break up those traditional, you know, neighborhoods where African Americans and Latinos have been able to create home ownership.
Well, certainly that's where we've seen development in the state so much to date, as more upper income areas have relied on exclusionary zoning, other tools to prevent apartment buildings from being built. So we have seen them go into predominantly neighborhoods of color. So I think that that perception is very much grounded in reality. Let's go to the callers. We have Maureen dialing in from Oakland. Maureen, you're on your call.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm in a real estate group, and we happen to have an attorney from Los Gatos speak up. It's a large group, like 70 people talking. She spoke on SB 9, and 189 cities from the California cities oppose it, San Jose being one that they'll change with some modifications. Some of the issues are the setbacks and the parking. But the other thing she mentioned is it's one of the some of the paragraphs in there penalize cities if they're not going along. There's something that's a penalty factor, and she said it puts cities in the position of being developers, and cities aren't developers. They're not supposed to be there to make a profit. And then it leaves it to the fire department to come in and say, well, you can't, this isn't safe. And my husband just looked at it a lot. He's a builder, and there's a lot of single homeowners that want it. They want rentals so they can make their retirement income. And he said, this lot doesn't even look safe to build four units on, let alone two. So what do you do about this penalty factor? Maybe somebody could expand on that.
Sure. Maureen, thank you for raising that. I can just say that I have not seen penalties in the bill. I do know that in general in California, cities and counties are responsible for making sure a certain amount of housing gets built under a separate provision of law. So that may be what that comment was about, that there's it's called the housing element where cities and counties are required to at least make available land to build a certain number of low income and moderate income type housing units. And then I know there are restrictions as to where these lot splits could happen. So it's an interesting question about where that might be limited, particularly in areas that might be at risk for wildfires. And Robin Yurovich, who's joining us from Capital Maine, did you have any responses to what Maureen was raising there?
Well, I think one thing she raises, the idea that when she brought up what she called the penalty factor, I mean, I think one of the reasons why there's so much opposition to this is California's newly strengthened housing law that says now that even previously exclusive cities now have to open the way for more low-income housing, and they have to zone land at levels dense enough to accommodate low-income housing. And, you know, that's something that could really change the face of California and essentially get rid of exclusivity, you know, of cities like Los Gatos, maybe, or, you know, places in Marin County or Hillsborough or Atherton, for example. You know, it could create a big change. And I think that that's one reason cities are upset. They also face another requirement, and that is to, under a new fair housing law in California, to look at segregation and to take steps to dismantle it. And those are big requirements, and they're new, and I think they're very daunting for a lot of small cities.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to point out that there are other cities around the country that have moved to end single-family zoning: Minneapolis, Charlotte, Portland, Sacramento. But only so far, Oregon has passed state-level ban on single-family housing, so that would put California in that company. But I just want to end by just talking about some of the backers of this bill. And Robin, we know that some of the most powerful interests in the state are supporting it: the California Chamber of Commerce, the Building Industry Association, tech companies like Facebook, cities like Oakland and San Diego, Sacramento Mayor Daryl Steinberg, along with affordable housing developers. Can you talk about some of the support in just our last minute here?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It puts legislators in an interesting position. I mean, where some of their constituents, you know, very much opposed to this, and then also big money supporters supporting it. So it is really interesting that in some ways, you know, for some legislators, SB9 especially might have been a hard vote to take, but maybe not so much, because then a lot of these big money backers are also behind it.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but we'll see what happens with SB 9 and SB 10. It'll go to the governor, and it'll be on his desk at least until October 10th. So we'll have to stay tuned. I want to thank Robin Yurovich, staff reporter for Capital Maine, for joining us on the show. Thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Your Call is produced at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows, you can visit yourcallradio.org, or you can find us on Apple Podcasts. Also, follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio, and email us with show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. I want to thank all of you, our listeners, as well as Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. And I want to thank Joanne Marr, our studio engineer today. I'm Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for joining us. This is Your Call.